Chapter 27. Of our honorable friend's political views ought, immediately, to have settled Tupkison's business, and covered him with confusion. But, that implacable person, regardless of the execrations that were heaped upon him from all sides, by which we mean, of course, from our honorable friend's side, persisted in retaining an unmoved countenance, and obstinately retorted that, if our honorable friend meant that, he wished to know what that meant. It was in repelling this most objectionable and indecent opposition that our honorable friend displayed his highest qualifications for the representation of verbosity. His warmest supporters present, and those who were best acquainted with his generalship, supposed that the moment was come when he would fall back upon the sacred bulwarks of our nationality. No such thing. He replied thus, my good friend Tupkison, gentlemen, wishes to know what I mean when he asks me what we are driving at, and when I candidly tell him, at the illimitable perspective, he wishes, if I understand him, to know what I mean? I do. Says Tupkison, amid cries of shame, and down with him. Gentlemen, says our honorable friend, I will indulge my good friend Tupkison by telling him both what I mean and what I don't mean.
Cheers and cries of give it him.
Be it known to him then, and to all whom it may concern, that I do mean altars, hearths, and homes, and that I don't mean mosques and Mohammedanism. The effect of this home thrust was terrific. Tupkison, who is a Baptist, was hooted down and hustled out, and has ever since been regarded as a Turkish renegade who contemplates an early pilgrimage to Mecca. Nor was he the only discomfited man. The charge, while it stuck to him, was magically transferred to our honorable friend's opponent, who was represented in an immense variety of placards as a firm believer in Mahomet. And the men of verbosity were asked to choose between our honorable friend and the Bible, and our honorable friend's opponent and the Quran. They decided for our honorable friend, and rallied round the illimitable perspective. It has been claimed for our honorable friend, with much appearance of reason, that he was the first to bend sacred matters to electioneering tactics. However this may be, the fine precedent was undoubtedly set in a verbosity election. And it is certain that our honorable friend, who was a disciple of Brahma in his youth, and was a Buddhist, when we had the honor of traveling with him a few years ago, always professes in public more anxiety than the whole bench of bishops, regarding the theological and doxological opinions of every man, woman, and child, in the United Kingdom. As we began by saying, that our honorable friend has got in again at this last election, and that we are delighted to find that he has got in, so we will conclude. Our honorable friend cannot come in for verbosity too often. It is a good sign. It is a great example. It is to men like our honorable friend, and to contests like those from which he comes triumphant, that we are mainly indebted for that ready interest in politics, that fresh enthusiasm in the discharge of the duties of citizenship, that ardent desire to rush to the poll, at present so manifest throughout England. When the contest lies, as it sometimes does, between two such men as our honorable friend, it stimulates the finest emotions of our nature, and awakens the highest admiration of which our heads and hearts are capable. It is not too much to predict that our honorable friend will be always at his post in the ensuing session. Whatever the question be, or whatever the form of its discussion, address to the Crown, election petition, expenditure of the public money, extension of the public suffrage, education, crime, in the whole House, in committee of the whole House, in select committee, in every parliamentary discussion of every subject, everywhere, the honorable member for verbosity will most certainly be found. Our school, we went to look at it, only this last midsummer, and found that the railway had cut it up root and branch. A great trunk line had swallowed the playground, sliced away the schoolroom, and pared off the corner of the house. which, thus curtailed of its proportions, presented itself, in a green stage of stucco, profile-wise towards the road, like a forlorn flat iron without a handle, standing on end. It seems as if our schools were doomed to be the sport of change. We have faint recollections of a preparatory day school, which we have sought in vain, and which must have been pulled down to make a new street, ages ago. We have dim impressions, scarcely amounting to a belief, that it was over a dyer's shop. We know that you went up steps to it, that you frequently grazed your knees in doing so, that you generally got your leg over the scraper, in trying to scrape the mud off a very unsteady little shoe. The mistress of the establishment holds no place in our memory, but, rampant on one eternal doormat, in an eternal entry long and narrow, is a puffy pug dog, with a personal animosity towards us, who triumphs over time. The bark of that billful pug, a certain radiating way he had of snapping at our undefended legs, the ghastly grinning of his moist black muzzle and white teeth, and the insolence of his crisp tail curled like a pastoral crook, all live and flourish. From an otherwise unaccountable association of him with a fiddle, we conclude that he was of French extraction, and his name Fiddle. He belonged to some female, chiefly inhabiting a back parlor, whose life appears to us to have been consumed in sniffing, and in wearing a brown beaver bonnet. For her, he would sit up and balance cake upon his nose, and not eat it until 20 had been counted. To the best of our belief, we were once called in to witness this performance, when, unable, even in his milder moments, to endure our presence, he instantly made at us, cake and all. Why a something in mourning, called Miss Frost, apostrophe should still connect itself with our preparatory school, we are unable to say. We retain no impression of the beauty of Miss Frost, if she were beautiful, or of the mental fascinations of Miss Frost, if she were accomplished, yet her name and her black dress hold an enduring place in our remembrance. An equally impersonal boy, whose name has long since shaped itself unalterably into Master Moll's, apostrophe is not to be dislodged from our brain. Retaining no vindictive feeling towards Moll's, no feeling whatever, indeed we infer that neither he, nor we can have loved Miss Frost. Our first impression of death and burial is associated with this formless pair. We all three nestled awfully in a corner one wintry day, when the wind was blowing shrill, with Miss Frost's pinafore over our heads, and Miss Frost told us in a whisper about somebody being screwed down. Apostrophe, it is the only distinct recollection we preserve of these impalpable creatures, except a suspicion that the manners of Master Moll's were susceptible of much improvement. Generally speaking, we may observe that, whenever we see a child intently occupied with its nose, to the exclusion of all other subjects of interest, our mind reverts, in a flash, to Master Moll's. But, the school that was our school before the railroad came and overthrew it, was quite another sort of place. We were old enough to be put into Virgil when we went there, and to get prizes for a variety of polishing on which the rust has long accumulated. It was a school of some celebrity in its neighborhood, nobody could have said why, and we had the honor to attain and hold the eminent position of first boy. The master was supposed among us to know nothing, and one of the ushers was supposed to know everything. We are still inclined to think the first named supposition perfectly correct. We have a general idea that its subject had been in the leather trade, and had bought us, meaning our school, of another proprietor who was immensely learned. Whether this belief had any real foundation, we are not likely ever to know now. The only branches of education with which he showed the least acquaintance were ruling and corporally punishing. He was always ruling, ciphering books with a bloated mahogany ruler, or smiting the palms of offenders with the same diabolical instrument, or viciously drawing a pair of pantaloons tight with one of his large hands, and caning the wearer with the other. We have no doubt whatever that this occupation was the principal solace of his existence. A profound respect for money pervaded our school, which was, of course, derived from its chief. We remember an idiotic goggle-eyed boy, with a big head and half crowns without end, who suddenly appeared as a parlor boarder, and was rumored to have come by sea from some mysterious part of the earth, where his parents rolled in gold. He was usually called apostrophe Mr. Apostrophe by the chief, and was said to feed in the parlor on steaks and gravy, likewise to drink currant wine. And he openly stated that, if rolls and coffee were ever denied him at breakfast, he would write home to that unknown part of the globe from which he had come, and cause himself to be recalled to the regions of gold. He was put into no form or class, but learned alone, as little as he liked, and he liked very little, and there was a belief among us, that this was because he was too wealthy to be taken down. Apostrophe his special treatment, and our vague association of him with the sea, and with storms, and sharks, and coral reefs occasioned the wildest legends, to be circulated as his history. A tragedy in blank verse was written on the subject, if our memory does not deceive us, by the hand, that now chronicles these recollections in which his father figured as a pirate, and was shot for a voluminous catalogue of atrocities. First imparting to his wife the secret of the cave in which his wealth was stored, and from which his only son's half-crowns now issued. Dumbledon, the boy's name, was represented as yet unborn, when his brave father met his fate, and the despair and grief of Mrs. Dumbledon at that calamity was movingly shadowed forth as having weakened the parlor boarder's mind. This production was received with great favor, and was twice performed with closed doors, in the dining room. But, it got wind, and was seized as libelous, and brought the unlucky poet into severe affliction. Some 2 years afterwards, all of a sudden one day, Dumbledon vanished. It was whispered that the chief himself had taken him down to the docks, and reshipped him for the Spanish main. But nothing certain was ever known about his disappearance. At this hour, we cannot thoroughly disconnect him from California. Our school was rather famous for mysterious pupils. There was another, a heavy young man, with a large double-cased silver watch, and a fat knife the handle, of which was a perfect toolbox, who unaccountably appeared one day at a special desk of his own, erected close to that of the chief, with whom he held familiar converse. He lived in the parlor, and went out for his walks, and never took the least notice of us, even of us, the first boy, unless to give us a deprecatory kick, or grimly to take our hat off, and throw it away, when he encountered us out of doors, which unpleasant ceremony he always performed as he passed, not even condescending to stop for the purpose. Some of us believed that the classical attainments of this phenomenon were terrific, but that his penmanship and arithmetic were defective, and he had come there to mend them. Others, that he was going to set up a school, and had paid the chief £25 down, apostrophe for leave to see our school at work. The gloomier spirits even said that he was going to buy us, against which contingency, conspiracies were set on foot for a general defection and running away. However, he never did that. After staying for a quarter, during which period, though closely observed, he was never seen to do anything but make pens out of quills, write small hand in a secret portfolio, and punch the point of the sharpest blade in his knife into his desk all over it, he too disappeared, and his place knew him no more. There was another boy, a fair, meek boy, with a delicate complexion and rich curling hair, who, we found out, or thought we found out, we have no idea now, and probably had none then, on what grounds, but it was confidentially revealed from mouth to mouth, was the son of a viscount who had deserted his lovely mother. It was understood that if he had his rights, he would be worth 20,000 a year. And that if his mother ever met his father, she would shoot him with a silver pistol, which he carried, always loaded to the muzzle, for that purpose. He was a very suggestive topic. So was a young mulatto, who was always believed, though very amiable, to have a dagger about him somewhere. But, we think they were both outshone, upon the whole, by another boy who claimed to have been born on the 29th of February, and to have only one birthday in 5 years,
We suspect this to have been a fiction, but he lived upon it all the time he was at our school. The principal currency of our school was slate pencil. It had some inexplicable value that was never ascertained, never reduced to a standard. To have a great hoard of it was somehow to be rich. We used to bestow it in charity and confer it as a precious boon upon our chosen friends. When the holidays were coming, contributions were solicited for certain boys whose relatives were in India and who were appealed for under the generic name of holiday stoppers, apostrophe appropriate marks of remembrance that should enliven and cheer them in their homeless state. Personally, we always contributed these tokens of sympathy in the form of slate pencil, and always felt that it would be a comfort and a treasure to them. Our school was remarkable for white mice. Red poles, linnets, and even canaries were kept in desks, drawers, hat boxes, and other strange refuges for birds, but white mice were the favorite stock. The boys trained the mice much better than the masters trained the boys. We recall one white mouse, who lived in the cover of a Latin dictionary, who ran up ladders, drew Roman chariots, shouldered muskets, turned wheels, and even made a very creditable appearance on the stage as the dog of Montargis. He might have achieved greater things, but for having the misfortune to mistake his way in a triumphal procession to the Capitol, when he fell into a deep inkstand, and was dyed black and drowned. The mice were the occasion of some most ingenious engineering in the construction of their houses and instruments of performance. The famous one belonged to a company of proprietors, some of whom have since made railroads, engines, and telegraphs. The chairman has erected mills and bridges in New Zealand. The usher at our school, who was considered to know everything as opposed to the chief, who was considered to know nothing, was a bony, gentle-faced, clerical-looking young man in rusty black. It was whispered that he was sweet upon one of Maxby's sisters. Maxby lived close by and was a day pupil, and further that he favored Maxby. Apostrophe, as we remember, he taught Italian to Maxby's sisters on half holidays. He once went to the play with them and wore a white waistcoat and a rose, which was considered among us equivalent to a declaration. We were of opinion on that occasion that to the last moment he expected Maxby's father to ask him to dinner at 5 o'clock, and therefore neglected his own dinner at 1:30, and finally got none. We exaggerated in our imaginations the extent to which he punished Maxby's father's cold meat at supper, and we agreed to believe that he was elevated with wine and water when he came home. But we all liked him, for he had a good knowledge of boys, and would have made it a much better school if he had had more power. He was writing master, mathematical master, English master, made out the bills, mended the pens, and did all sorts of things. He divided the little boys with the Latin master. They were smuggled through their rudimentary books at odd times when there was nothing else to do, and he always called at parents' houses to inquire after sick boys, because he had gentlemanly manners. He was rather musical, and on some remote quarter day had bought an old trombone, but a bit of it was lost, and it made the most extraordinary sounds when he sometimes tried to play it of an evening. His holidays never began, on account of the bills, until long after hours. But in the summer vacations he used to take pedestrian excursions with a knapsack, and at Christmas time he went to see his father at Chipping Norton, who we all said, on no authority, was a dairy-fed pork butcher. Poor fellow! He was very low all day on Maxby's sister's wedding day, and afterwards was thought to favor Maxby more than ever, though he had been expected to spite him. He has been dead these 20 years. Poor fellow! Our remembrance of our school presents the Latin master as a colorless, doubled-up, near-sighted man with a crutch, who was always cold, and always putting onions into his ears for deafness, and always disclosing ends of flannel under all his garments, and almost always applying a ball of pocket handkerchief to some part of his face with a screwing action round and round. He was a very good scholar, and took great pains, where he saw intelligence and a desire to learn. Otherwise, perhaps not. Our memory presents him unless teased into a passion, with as little energy as color as having been worried, and tormented into monotonous feebleness as having had the best part of his life ground out of him in a mill of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.